All right, and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Snack Time with Mike and Ant. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ant Tessitore, a writer at Gathering Magic, and I also do a names and flavor text writing for Wizards of the Coast.
Okay.
With me, as always, is the very flavorful Mike Linneman, Master of Weens.
Hello.
And with us today, we have a very, very special guest, our annual... Now annual, actually, I can't even believe I'm saying that. Our annual holiday guest, Mr. Ethan Fleischer.
Hello, hello. Has it really been a year already?
It really has.
Funny how that works.
All right, so I'm a game designer. I work for Wizards of the Coast, and I specialize in designing Magic the Gathering sets. So, hi.
Well, hello. We'll put a link. They can search for it. But let's get into it right away. Holiday time. Flavor gems, right to the flavor. Ant, lead us off. What do you got today?
All right, today I got a double dose of holiday flavor. I have a red card with a green kicker in honor of Christmas, and it's Tin Street Hooligan from the, I believe that's Guild Pact set. So going back to the first time we were on Ravnica, I picked this card because the flavor text is all about Rakchav. It's like a holiday, only instead of it being on calendars and instead of dancing, you just knock people flat and you don't give gifts. You just break stuff in true Gruul fashion.
Sounds great.
That is one of my favorite goblins, I have to say.
Oh, really? That's one of my favorite holidays. But I, other than, what's the Rakdos holiday where it just rains blood? Man, I can't think of it.
from Revelations.
It's gonna drive me crazy. But whatever. I mean, if I can't be Rakdos, then I can settle for being a Gruul. So
it's close enough.
Close enough.
Art
gets the job done.
So I went a different route. Minnesota right now has no snow where I'm at, which is the strangest thing. I blame Al Gore and. We always have snow. It's what we're known
for. Man, bear, pig.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like negative 30, and it's like 45 degrees here, and my wiener dogs aren't even wearing coats on their walk. It's stupid. So into more of the cultural things of my area, I'm thinking Folk of the Pines, old school Ice Age card. Is it a 5-drop, 2/5? You know it is. Does it cost 2 full mana to give it +1/+0? Yep. But why I like this is this art. It's two artists, a collaboration, which we rarely see anymore. Even Therese had a collaboration piece, but two different people worked on it. And it's Nanny Thomas and Catherine Buck. Catherine Buck actually is an amazing artist, just hasn't worked in Magic in a long, long time. The art is really just a woman in a snowy coat. It's a fur coat. And I like this because it reminds you of this holiday gala, this holiday party where you wear this mink of this old school sort of holiday tradition sort of thing. I don't know why this dryad is a 2/5, but I think the art's fun. It's simplistic. It almost feels like it's out of the 1950s. And I dig it. I'm totally a fan of some of that old school Ice Age art.
This card is so weird.
It's super weird.
Like, this woman's in the middle of a bunch of frozen trees and she has fire breathing.
Yep. So next turn, she comes into play, she can hit as a 5/5, which makes no sense. But I'm okay with it. I'm okay. Art's cool.
So that's a 5/5 for 11 mana.
Yep, nailed it. All right, Ethan, what do you got for us today?
All right, so my flavor gem for this holiday season is Phyrexian Snow Crusher.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the Cold Snap expansion. I really just love the art of this piece. There is this gigantic, blue, glowing, one-eyed cyborg death machine towering over the landscape. And then you look in the foreground, and there's this little shack, and there's a woodcutter there, and he's dropping his axe. And he's just the juxtaposition of the cyborg death machine and this sort of pastoral forest scene here that they just have nothing to do with each other, and it really emphasizes how alien and otherworldly this monster is, because here's this guy, he is just not equipped to deal. He's just like, I can't even lift my axe against this thing because I don't stand a chance.
Yeah, it's funny that the flavor text is alluding to the fact that the plow is designed to carve a path through armies, and this giant siege weapon is just instead deciding to carve its way through this one dude's house.
Yep.
Poor little guy. All right, so I have a real quick aside. So if you guys noticed, Mike picked a green card, I picked a red card. Ethan, your card, as you said, has a little bit of blue in it. Now, as I grew up, my brother and I always got into arguments over whether or not blue is a tertiary Christmas color.
Oh.
So I'm wondering what you guys think about that. Because I think that it is not.
Yeah, I
at don't all.
I think white might be a tertiary Christmas color. You know, like Santa Claus's outfit is trimmed with white, right?
Yeah, and there's white snow. I would buy that.
Yeah.
But white's not really a color, but that's okay.
Wait, I would buy it. I'm going to say maybe, because, I mean, back in old country, mind you, I grew up in Germany until I was a little kid, Black Forest style. It was basically Kessig. Blue is constant, because it's always the Frohe Weihnachten is in – it's always blue. I don't know why, but it's generally blue when they have it written or any sort of cards or like church scenes. It's just blue because blue made was a little easier than black, and it allowed by blue and white, it showed more as winter. So I don't know. I think in a foreign sense, there is some semblance that blue is a little more common, especially with Bavaria, you know, state color, sort of the blue and white for Bayern Munich. I don't know. I'm going to say, especially with St. Nick not always being red, sometimes he wears blue. I'm going to say maybe. I'm going to say tertiary. Yes. I'm going to argue with the two of you about it.
So it sounds like we have a majority that blue is not a tertiary color. Sorry, Nate.
Struggle.
Overruled. We put it to a vote. I'm sorry, you're just wrong, Mike.
Just put a,
Mike,
put a counter spell in.
You're right, just incorrect. You're, Mike, you're bad at colors.
Shocker, it's blue that does it. Mm-hmm. All right, so holiday season. Ethan, you're here. We got the holiday card. Just came out. Can you tell us anything about Goblin Sleigh Ride?
All right, so Goblin Sleigh Ride, this is the newest Magic holiday card. This goes out to employees of Wizards of the Coast, business partners of Wizards of the Coast. It's not available in booster packs. This is a special reward for people we really, really like and people that we know. So this is called Goblin Sleigh Ride. It's one and a red mana for a sorcery. It says, target creature you control climbs onto Goblin Sleigh Ride. You slide them on their merry way. If the creature stayed on it, it deals damage equal to its toughness to each other creature touched during the slide. And the flavor text says, what fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. But, of course, slaying is S-L-A-Y-ing. And then we have a picture here, and there's a really happy little goblin, and he's riding on this sled, which appears to be made out of Doran the Siege Tower, who's a legendary tree folk from Magic's past.
Okay, so first question I have. Obviously intentional that Mark got called up to do the art.
Yeah, we gotta get the old school in here.
You got to get the Doran right, so you got to call the guy that made it, because he hasn't made it much art lately in years. So I'm happy to see.
Oh, he is. He's still in. We have him a lot. We use Mark Zug all the time. I mean, he's, you know, maybe not like in multiple cards in every set, but you know,
he's still on the roster. He doesn't get his, you know, 6-7 cards like he used to, but yes.
Wait. Doran's legs have been reshapen into a sled?
Yeah, yeah. Look at that.
Oh, that's
Or
horrible.
Maybe those are his arms. I'm not sure.
That's so mean.
I think those are his legs.
I'm pretty sure those are his legs.
Yeah, or maybe he's just standing on sleigh runners. I don't know.
Possible. So how does
he did a great job of making this look like Doran is so cold. And he lost all his leaves because it's winter, I guess, right? But man, wait, so this is on Lorwyn, obviously. So that's a Boggart.
I assume. It must be.
A little Boggart.
Okay, so
unless some sort of bizarre space-time flux has happened and Doran is on some plane with a different kind of goblin. But, you know, Silver Border cards. They could be anywhere. It could be in the Silver Border universe. This could be an alternate universe, Doran.
Sure. Oh, true.
This could be in the same universe where Urza's head is chilling out in a hot tub, sipping on a drink.
Makes sense. So how did this come to be? Like, how? What was the meeting or the cocktail hour, or how did this come up that, you know, we're going to put it on top of the card and see what happens?
Oh, well, the art came in and it had a goblin riding on a sled. And we were like, what the hell is this thing? It's got Doran and he's a sleigh and there's a goblin on it. This is crazy. So, this was one where the art came first and we tried to figure out what the card should do for the art.
Okay,
so,
that's interesting.
Yeah, we do it different ways in different years. And this was one where the art came in, and it was a funny-looking piece, and it was, like, really interesting. And it took us a while. We had to argue about this one for a while, but we always try to put some gameplay element or something in the rules text that we couldn't do in a black bordered normal magic card. Like, we always try to put something in there where if you give it to a magic judge, he'll just throw up his hands and say, I don't know what, it's not in the comprehensive rule book. I don't know what to do with this.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah. So we were just goofing around. We were thinking about, like, oh, what are some physical actions you could do? What do you do with a sleigh? Well, you slide along the ground with it. So, you know, after a lot of arguing, this was all of the core designers. So this would have been Mark Rosewater, Mark Gottlieb, myself, Sean Main, Ken Nagel, Jackie Lee, and Gavin Verhey, I believe, were in this meeting. And, yeah, we just hashed it out. And eventually we figured out that, like, you could have something ride on this card. I think Ken Nagel is the one who came up with the final rules for this one. You could have a creature ride on this sleigh, and whatever it bumps into gets knocked over, gets hit, and takes damage.
Fantastic.
So have you tried it?
We did try it. We did some sliding around. We did a few tests to see.
How do you get it to work?
Well, it's all about the application of butter, or if you don't have any handy, you can use, like, ski wax.
Because I proxied this card, like, just to test it.
Oh, yeah, you have to use the actual card, or it's not going to work right.
And I just can't get my guy to, like, stay on top of it.
Have you ever used a Chaos Orb, Ant?
Yes.
See, like, and you know, like, this takes practice. You're not going to just, like, take out all your opponent's permanents on the first time. This is going to take a little work. Obviously, the sledding conditions matter also. You're not going to be able to just, like a wicker table or something. You're not going to get much headway.
So. Right.
If you're camping, not going to work.
I will say that it brought me back to my days of playing paper football.
And how
you could get that down to a science.
That's been a long time.
Yeah. That's like the first thing I thought. Like, when I slid it across the table for the first time, I was just like, ooh. Like, that was nostalgia right there.
Fun.
So, yeah, this isn't one of those super easy to use holiday cards like Stocking Tiger or something where all you need to do
is Snow Globe.
Yeah. I mean, that requires some dexterity. You have to tap it and untap it and then tap it and then untap it and then tap it again. So
right.
That one's at least, it's a little hard on the wrists.
Right.
So do you know who wrote this art description? Or did you just, like, contact Mark Zug and just say, hey, give us a holiday picture?
Well, it was definitely, it was definitely none of the magic designers. We don't write art descriptions. That is the art department that does that. I don't know which of the art directors handled this particular one, I'm afraid. We were bouncing ideas around. We were like, we wanted something with a tree folk. And, this is what came back. So
super fun. All right, well then, we're here then for the next set that we're current. Well, the next thing on our list is the set we're in. Big old battle happening, and
a battle for Zendikar.
There was some sort of battle on Zendikar for Zendikar,
mm-hmm.
Of course. would love to hear some insight into revisiting the plane and designing for Eldrazi instead of taking the old file and kind of copying to say, oh, the design's going to be, you know, similar to this. How did you go through deviating while still keeping it true that people play during Rise, they know that they're the same Eldrazi?
Yeah, designing, especially the Eldrazi for Battle for Zendikar, was a huge challenge for us. It was really difficult. The Eldrazi that everybody remembers from Rise of the Eldrazi are these gigantic creatures, 8 mana up to 15 mana. Absolutely huge, absolutely destructive. Each one of them had the Annihilator ability, yeah, which made the defending player exile a certain number of cards, or sacrifice a certain number of permanents whenever the Eldrazi attacked.
Right.
This was kind of miserable. Like, we didn't enjoy that very much. Sitting across the table from an Eldrazi is a very helpless feeling. Yeah. You know, normally when something is killing you in Magic, you have hope. You have some hope that you can draw an answer. You can draw a spell that will get you out of it. Well, pretty quickly your lands are going away, and so it's kind of gets to the point where it's like, well, even if I do draw the card that I need, am I going to be able to cast it? No, I've got 2 lands left. This is hopeless. Right. So
it's, we very wanted to much find a win more.
Yeah, we didn't. Yes, it is to win more, and it's just kind of soul crushing. So we wanted to be able to have the Eldrazi be much more present in this set. We wanted the Eldrazi to be, to take up half the set, basically. We want half the creatures to be Eldrazi so that it could be a full-scale battle between the Zendikari and the Eldrazis. So to accomplish that, we needed to make some of them smaller, and we couldn't give them all Annihilator anymore. If there were, like, we did a little figuring out, we were like, what would happen if we had a 1-1 with Annihilator 1? How much mana would that cost? Well, 4 mana minimum, and that's probably a terrible idea anyway. So
we
knew that we had to get rid of Annihilator. So what we wanted to do is kind of focus a mechanic into each of the Eldrazi brood lineages. So there's Ulamog's brood lineage, and there's Kozilek's brood lineage, and there's Emrakul's brood lineage. And we knew that Battle for Zendikar was going to be all about Ulamog, and only his brood lineage was going to be prominent in the set. So in Ulamog, we kind of split things up. We kind of took all of the sort of jumbled mishmash of different things that all the Eldrazi could do in Rise of the Eldrazi and kind of split it up so that each brood lineage, each Eldrazi Titan had its own portfolio. And Ulamog's portfolio was eating stuff. So we made his mechanic all about eating things. So we had the ingest mechanic. We had the processors. So that you could eat your opponent's cards, put them in the exile, and then process them, put them into their graveyard from exile, sort of like digesting it. And that way it felt like all the smaller Eldrazi were hooked up to the larger Eldrazi as sort of one gigantic organism.
So did that come earlier on? Because Brood Warden existed back in original Rise that said, oh, we have drones. We can make, there can be different kinds of Eldrazi.
Yep. Yeah, we were definitely thinking about those, and we kind of, you know, obviously those existed in Rise of the Eldrazi. These were green Eldrazi or red Eldrazi or black Eldrazi that could make Eldrazi spawn tokens.
Sure.
We were certainly keeping them in mind. We wanted all the Eldrazi to be colorless here, but we kind of wanted to have our cake and eat it too. We wanted them to be colorless and have this colorless frame so they would look weird and otherworldly and distinctive, but we also wanted them to cost colored mana so that when you're building a deck, you have to make choices. If you can just put all the best cards in every deck, then every deck becomes the same deck and there's only one deck. And then you have to play against the same deck all the time. That's boring. So we, pardon me, we came up with this Devoid mechanic, which is a mechanic that makes it so that a spell costs colored mana, but is arbitrarily defined as being colorless. So cards that care about whether something is colorless care. Cards that care about color suddenly can't see this card, and the cards look like an Eldrazi.
So that was early on, too. That didn't happen after the fact to say, like, boy, we got to get rid of color here. Like, that was on probably earlier in the design file.
Yeah, I mean, we did a lot of discussion about how to make the Eldrazi in a modern New World Order compliant Magic set. New World Order is a series of, what is this, practices that make it so the set doesn't get too complex at lower rarities, so that inexperienced players don't get too confused when they play with the set. And honestly, a lot of the New World Order criteria that we use also just make the set more fun and more strategically interesting to play with, we found. So,
right.
Yeah, so in Rise of the Eldrazi was not New World Order compliant. It was wildly off base.
Far from it.
And, yeah, it was just like, it was totally baffling to lower level drafters. Very experienced drafters were like, oh, this is a very exciting and wild ride. I've never played anything like this. And the rest of them were just like, I just trying to play Magic here and I can't.
Right. So when you realized that, you wanted to really hammer down the colorless theme, did you know right away that you were going to lean towards multicolor or lots of colors for the allies?
No. That was something that we discussed during exploratory design, which is sort of the blue sky design period before we really start digging into the set. I was very excited about that idea. It felt like a really pleasing contrast to me. We sort of let that go in a formal way during design, though we still had this ally tribal theme, and there were allies in all of the colors. So, but the Converge mechanic, which rewards you for playing lots of colors of mana, actually was added into the file during development to add a little more texture to the set. So it was something that we discussed early, we dropped for a while, and then came back later in the process. And I'm happy it's back, because it really does feel like a really great contrast. Like, I imagine the person who's playing an all Eldrazi deck and everything is colorless on his side of the table, and then his opponent is playing an ally deck with some Converge cards, and she has cards of every color on her side. It's sort of gray versus rainbow kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. I really like that contrast a lot. It just goes as simple as like White Knight, Black Knight, right? Like, it's very straightforward mirror images of each other that can easily define, who your allies are, depending on which side of the battlefield you're on. You know, it's very similar to how in, Scars of Mirrodin, how you could very easily tell, which side was Mirrodin and which side was Phyrexia. Mm-hmm. They somewhat shared blue, but for all intents and purposes, the Mirrodins were primarily what, red and white, yep, and the Phyrexians were black and green.
Yeah.
So,
and for draft, yeah.
Right, for draft. So you definitely got this nice division, of color split across your two armies. So I liked seeing that same idea, but a different twist on it, where it's all five colors on one side and the other side is you get no colors.
Okay, so if allies are flavored as all the colors, and Eldrazi, from a flavorful sense, we don't really know how they get there. Like, we understand the Zendikar people are Zendikar races are there, and they're binding together. You get Converge, cool. We heard from the storyline that these sires somehow create Eldrazi, whether they like flop out of them, like it's Cloverfield the movie, or they materialize or what have you. But this colorless thing is really, really interesting. And Ant and I were talking about this before the show quite a bit, that we have this colorless only and colorless mana, but all the Eldrazi are all colorless.
Well, just to be clear, that's in Oath now, right? So, Ethan, the set that you were the lead designer on, Oath of the Gatewatch, so we've seen, it was Kozilek, I believe?
Yes.
Was shown during the World Magic?
That's right. Yeah, we revealed Kozilek, and we revealed a new basic land card called Wastes, at the World Magic Cup. So Kozilek costs colorless mana, and so you have to use mana with no color to cast Kozilek.
Right. So we got a new mana symbol that is colorless only, right? So that's what designates that you have to use colorless mana. And so what's interesting to me now is that we have the potential to have, I've been calling it the flavor of colorless. But so, for example, when you see a red card or a card that has red mana symbols on it, you're immediately going to think, you know, passion, rage, fury. Like, there are these certain buzzwords that kind of come to mind for red mana. For green, you might think growth, right?
But they also have art that's changed that, too. It used to be green card has green colors in it, and then red card has rage and everything's red and furious. And now that no longer became an art standard, and they say, well, let's open it up, make it a little... I mean, goblins are still going to be red, usually, but... It seems like the devoid mechanic is needed currently, but in the future it may not be because people are just going to know, oh, it's a colorless card.
Yeah, and actually during design we assumed that the frame would just communicate enough. And maybe we would need some little mark on it somewhere to indicate that it doesn't have a color, but for rules purposes. But in our testing, in our play testing, we brought in some people from outside R&D and tried out the cards on them with different frames and different rules texts. And the thing that the most people understood was having this devoid keyword that spelled out exactly what was going on.
Right. And that was something that I think Mark Rosewater talked about a little bit in his one article, where he was saying that it's really hard to have a symbol that represents the lacking of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, oh, what do? You have a nothing there, and you can just see the art through it. Well, you're going to see something there. The art has a color. It's going to be a purple tentacle through there, or somebody's, you know, a blue arm, or something's going to be under there. So, but as far as the flavor of colorless, and the flavor of the Eldrazi in a lot of ways, we are definitely trying to be as ambiguous and inscrutable as possible.
Yes, we want exactly what I thought. Okay.
We want these creatures to be unknowable and alien. Their concerns have nothing to do with human concerns. Their motivations have nothing to do with human motivations, aside from Ulamog being very hungry. Obviously, that's something we can all sympathize with.
Yep.
But, Kozilek especially, he is the reality warper. And he comes from outside of normal space-time. He's from the Blind Eternities, which is the space in between worlds, if you can wrap your head around that idea.
Right.
So it is not a place exactly at all. So
Do you feel like there's some sort of, I don't know, area that this is starting off on an unknowable place? So obviously... This is colorless, and colorless before has just been, it's normal mana and, a little bit colorless thing, like an artifact. Anybody can use it. But now, colorless is a thing. It's Eldrazi. It's an unexplainable thing. So, in 3 years from now, maybe there's some astral or in-between plane wizard creature that is also colorless.
Right, you'll notice that the symbol on Kozilek is not like a picture of an Eldrazi.
Right.
It's a sort of geometrically constructed shape of three different, four quarters of a circle, flipped around 180 degrees and connected to each other in a vaguely diamond-shaped pattern, which looks sort of a little bit like a hedron, but it doesn't have straight sides like a hedron. It's not a hedron. It is deliberately not flavored to be an Eldrazi shape.
Got it.
So if we want to use it, probably not 3 years from now, but if we want to use it 10 years from now for some other completely different purpose, the tool is available to us.
Right. Okay. So did you guys...
One question. So one thing that I'm really interested in, though, is like, so before we had... like Mike was saying, we had artifacts, right?
Right.
And artifacts were flavored as colorless because anyone could use them. So a lot of times they were effects that we saw on other colors or in other cards, but more expensive. Or they would be just very generic effects that, you know, a lot of colors would have access to.
Right.
But now we have, so colorless effects, like what is a colorless effect? Like this would be something that no color should have access to, or like what's the best way to think about that?
So in general, what we did for this set, I don't really go into too much detail because I can't really talk about specific examples because the cards aren't out there, aren't available, and we can't really see them. But in general, we were trying to think of like what would Kozilek do? What does it mean to be Kozilek? So taking it, you know, from a flavorful standpoint, coming up with mechanics that felt Kozilek-y and then attaching those to these colorless mana costs. So that Kozilek essentially has his own little slice of the color pie. Obviously, colorlessness is not a color, but in a lot of ways, in this set only, it acts like a color because you have cards that generate colorless mana and cards that require colorless mana to be cast. Those together, that's what a color is generally. You know, you have your islands, you can make blue mana, you can cast blue spells with it.
Right.
Normally a colorless spell, like an artifact, just costs generic mana. You can spend any color mana, you can spend colorless mana, you can spend any kind of mana you want to cast an artifact, but that's not how it is with Kozilek's brood lineage of Eldrazi.
Right. So was saving the colorless symbol for Oath, was that always the plan?
So the plan definitely evolved a lot during design and development. Initially, my plan as the lead designer for Oath of the Gatewatch was that it would only appear in costs. It would not appear on the Wastes card, for instance. It would just have a one, or it would say tap to add one to your mana pool. But we realized, Aaron Forsyth in particular, he's the director of Magic R&D, realized that, this is an opportunity to clean up our mana system and distinguish colorless mana from generic mana costs, which was this, for some reason, we had decided to make those two symbols the same thing. If you had a generic mana cost or a thing that tallies, Soul Ring taps for two colorless mana, That number two in a gray circle was the same thing. And that never actually made sense. It was an artifact of some early templating decisions that weren't really very consistent and weren't rational. So we took this opportunity to clean everything up.
Interesting. It's like you guys have like a laundry list of things that you're like, oh man, we gotta fix that thing eventually. Like, ugh. We gotta work on this other thing too.
Honestly, if this mechanic where you have to spend colorless mana for a cost hadn't come along, we probably would never have fixed this. But it was like, well, we're gonna go through all this work to make this work anyway. While we're in there tinkering with the mana symbols, let's just fix this little thing that's been ambiguous and confusing for new players for 10 years now.
Okay,
15 years now.
if that's a thing, we're going to learn more about what does it mean to be colorless mana. Like even there's no terminology for what is colorless. There's no color pie. There's no thing that it represents. It doesn't exist.
Right, it's brand new territory.
Is that coming in Oath to be like, okay, this is Kozilek's thing now, but in the future, we're going to keep looking at it? Or is it like, listen, we're doing it now, and yeah, we'll get to it again eventually? Or is this going to become kind of a new normal that you're going to use this as another design space?
I mean, if by new normal you mean, like, are these cards with colorless mana costs going to be in every set? No. It is not something we're going to do in every set. That is a special thing for Oath of the Gatewatch. At some point, I'm sure, if it's a popular thing, we might bring it back if it's thematically appropriate to a set. But no, it's not going to be the new normal. Though when a card makes colorless mana from now on, it will use the colorless mana symbols that we developed for this set.
Right. And that's to clear up the rules issue that you guys were, or the, not issue, but the, it's being more clear as to what's really happening.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. So I have a different question. It's on a similar topic, but the card Wastes, right? Mm-hmm. It's a basic land that makes colorless mana.
Yep.
Now it has no type.
Right.
So who came up with that idea? Because it's such a clean and straightforward, simple way around the Barry's Land problem. Like, it seems like one of those aha moments where you're like, oh, let's just take the type off. And everyone right. was like, oh my God, you did it.
So I was, when I was working on Commander 2014, which was last year's Commander product, I was talking with my team about, like, what should we do this time? Should we make monocolor decks? Should we make four-color decks? Should we make zero-color decks? Should we make a whole bunch of different color decks? I don't know. And so I was like, what about zero-color decks? And I was thinking about it. I was like, looking at how do you make a mana base, what kind of lands you put in a zero-color commander deck. And, oh, man, it was a mess. We're going to have to put so many weirdo lands in there. I was just thinking about, like, how confusing and bizarre it would have to be for us to make this product. I thought, well, what if we just cut through all this nonsense and just made a basic land that taps for colorless mana? So I went and talked to Matt Tabak, who's the rules manager. I said, Matt, how do we make a basic land that taps for colorless mana? And he just told me. He said, it just has to have the rules text, tap, add, well, at the time it said tap, add one to your mana pool. And just don't give it a basic land type. It doesn't need a new basic land type. It just needs rules text. We can put rules text on cards. We're Wizards of the Coast. We get to do that. So so I was like, all right, sounds great. And then I didn't use it, and I just put it aside.
Hold up. This was like a three-minute conversation between, mm-hmm. like, 2 6-foot-8-inch humans.
Right.
In the hallway, probably.
Yeah, I mean, it was in the office, but yeah. Yeah, so I talked it over. Clearly, he had thought about this and already knew. And I was like, great. I filed that away, and then I ended up making monocolor decks. So, you know, there was a mono-white deck and a mono-blue deck. We didn't have a colorless deck. But when we got around to Oath of the Gatewatch design, and we realized that, oh, we really wanted to use this colorless mana symbol. This is awesome. This is a really interesting thing to do. We were like, oh, we got to make a basic land. And Nagel was like, we really have to make a basic land. And I was like, I know how to do this. I already talked about this. I don't even need to check with anyone because I know what the right answer is. So, yeah, so it has to have rules text on it. You'll notice that the card you saw is a full art land. It doesn't have any rules text on it. How do we do that? Well, once again, we're Wizards of the Coast. We were just like, we're just doing this. We want it to look like this. Jeremy Jarvis was like, I want it to be full art so it looks like the rest of the lands in this set.
Makes sense.
Make it happen. And so the editing team made it happen. So how it works, the magic behind the magic is that we have this database called Oracle, which holds the updated rules text for all the cards. So like if there's an old card printed with the old rules, and it says, instead of saying enters the battlefield, it should say comes in, or it says comes into play, when it should say enters the battlefield, sure. or something like that. Well, we have the updated rules text in Oracle, which shows up in, on our website, and it tells you what the rules text should be if the card was printed today. So what we did was we printed these full art cards, and they look just like the rest of the Zendikar basic land cards with the full art. And in the Oracle text database, they will have rules text that says tap, add C to your mana pool.
Awesome.
And we just cheated, basically.
So I have a question. If you printed, let's say you printed Wastes in, I don't know, like some supplementary product down the road, right? Mm. And it was not full art.
Right.
What would be in the text box? Would it just be a watermark of the colorless symbol, similar to other basic lands? Or would it have rules text?
You're just going to have to wait and see, I'm afraid.
Dun, dun, dun. Business. kind of sneak out info, and I like
it. I tried.
I tried so hard.
The lands in the intro decks for this product will not be full art, though, so you'll get to see sooner than you think.
Oh. Oh. Well.
There you go.
All right. That's better. I don't feel as bad.
No. All right. That's illuminating. I got a couple whack-a-mole questions about Commander, and then, you know, we can get into other things in a minute, back to Zendikar. First thing I noticed is tokens were printed. Oh my god, yeah. Tokens were printed!
We did that last year, we did it again this year.
So this is totally an intentional thing. One of these years, they're going to be making the Spawn token, and the Pincer token... and all these other ones, and I'm so happy that you guys are slowly chipping away at these. It's such
you're
a fantastic thing.
I have a
thing.
Gigantic binder that I carry with me everywhere that is full of tokens. I collect these things like crazy. Yeah. Whenever I'm playing Commander, somebody's like, "All right, I'm gonna make 3 pest tokens." I'm like, "Oh, I don't have that one in stock." But then they're like, "All right, now I'm gonna make 3 elf warriors," and I'm like, "I've got that. I'm ready." So yeah, we are. I am. No one is more committed than me, with the possible exception of Aaron Forsyth, to filling in all the gaps in people's token collections.
That's fantastic. Love seeing that. Keep that up. I mean, any sort of supplemental products, cool. Vorthos loves the crap out of those, because some of those old artworks are so cool. They're so cool.
Right, yeah. We had to make sure that we got Pongify inside in Commander 2014 instead of what was the one from Gatecrash. Rapid hybridization.
Yep.
Yes.
We needed to get those tokens into people.
I'm still waiting on my star. What was a starfish? What's the one that makes little starfish?
Starfish.
Yeah.
Dude, it's coming next year. Commander.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Other things I noticed is that there were peaks into planes here, and I always get really excited about this. One of my favorite. Flavorful articles of the year is when Mel gave us an update on what the Planeswalkers were up to.
Right.
So I'm wondering on the design sense, how did you guys go through thinking, oh, we're going to peek into Mirrodin and see what they're doing, and oh, we're going to peek into Kamigawa. Like, how did that, was it an organic thing, or you guys just kind of threw a dart at a board, or how did you decide?
Part of it was, some of it was organic, some of it was very deliberate. Dan Emmons was the lead designer of this product, and Kelly Diggs from the writing team was the creative lead for the product, and he was also on the design team. So there was a lot of conversation between them. Dan really wanted to have the main commander have each one of them have an associated spell that connected to them creatively as well as mechanically to the plane they were from. So we did a lot of figuring out of what are the mechanics we want to put on these cards. We had Azuri. He's from New Phyrexia. Right. He's the Phyrexia, the completed version of Azuri Renegade Leader. And then we wanted to have a Phyrexian card associated with him. So we had a living weapon from New Phyrexia with the living weapon mechanic and the art of the germ driving a big claw machine.
Awesome.
So, yeah, we did that for each of the face commanders. As far as the peek into Kamigawa goes, I was adamant that we needed a snake tribal commander in blue-green. It was clearly the people need this.
People need a token. They needed the snake token.
Yeah, we needed the snake tokens, too.
We did need the commander, too.
We needed this commander.
Such a great blue-green snake commander deck, just it was there for so long, and people were just using random commanders that were just blue and green that didn't matter. Like you knew playing that deck, you're like, my commander doesn't matter because I'm summoning snakes all day every day,
right? And so I knew we needed this thing. I knew we had to do this, and where would a snake commander come from but Kamigawa, right? The land of the what are they called?
Orochi.
The Orochi. So we have Kasato, who is a descendant of Sesshiro. He's awesome. One of the Orochi. He's a little fancier. He's got some fancy robes, and he's, I believe, a wizard now instead of a shaman, mm-hmm. but or a monk. Were they monks?
Some of them. Yeah, anyway, I think they were monks.
Yeah, we got to peek in, see a very small window into what's happening in Kamigawa lately. And we got to peek in on New Phyrexia and see what's going on there. We got to peek in on Theros. Obviously, it hasn't been as long since we were there. But it's a nice opportunity to look in there, because we can't be everywhere at once. And people want to know what's going on. Whatever happened to Azuri? Whatever happened to Daxos?
Finger guns. He's the finger guns.
He's like, Daxos finger guns.
I can't unsee it now. I know it's such a minor thing, but it's like a blessing symbol. But he's finger guns. And
that card got previewed, and I immediately messaged Mike, and I'm like, Mike, what is Daxos doing with his fingers?
Finger guns. I love the card. It's super awesome, Adams. That's so freaking good. Oh, just fantastic.
Yeah. I really do like how you guys do that with the supplemental set. So how you know, like, we can only spend so much time on each of these planes as we, you know, go to different sets. And it's really, really nice to know that, you know, they're still living, breathing, evolving places where, you know, while we weren't there for the entire story of how Azuri got completed, just seeing that he was completed is enough to know that, hey, that war is still going on. There are still casualties. It's still a very real thing.
Yeah.
It also gives you an opportunity of fan service. Fan service, great. Kamigawa, great.
Yeah. Like, the commander sets are the greatest opportunity for fan service, I think, just because there are so few restrictions on them. On those cards, both creatively and developmentally. Like, we have a lot of freedom there to just do whatever the hell we want.
That's
hardly anybody's even supervising us. They're just like, go make a commander set. Let us know how much money we made. And it's like, okay, good.
That must be so fun. Like, every day.
It's super fun.
So, speaking of fan service, and Ethan, as a fellow Vorthos,
mm-hmm.
where is Feather?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we may have dropped the ball a little bit there, I admit.
Where's Feather?
Yeah. Where is Feather?
I've put Feather in, I think, at least two different products during design. I put him in the Gate Crash file, and I think I put him in somewhere else too. And it didn't go. It didn't fly. I think in retrospect, this Boros Angel in
Anya.
Red White Angel Anya probably should have been Feather.
I saw maybe. The art, and that's who I thought, like, initially that's who I thought it was.
Yep.
And I was immediately just going to jump on social media and just freak out because I was so excited. And then I realized that it couldn't be.
Yeah. The thing with Feather is that Feather's name is Feather. And I'm afraid that's a really stupid name. It's really bad. Like, what the heck?
Feather has a real name.
You could use Feather's...
real
name, but yep, it's yep. super
Feather
long.
Does have a very long name in some sort of bizarre, archaic Ravnican language.
It's super Slavic, but it's like they could. It's a challenge to overcome. We're just, you know, jumping on the megaphone to be like, "There's some Vorthos chatter here."
Yep.
Yeah.
No, I hear you, and I've been doing my part, but I can only do so much as not a member of the team that actually is responsible for naming cards.
Right.
But
truth.
As someone who does work on naming cards, I can't even believe I'm going to say this, but you could have used her full name and then in parentheses just put Feather.
I don't think we've ever had a. I don't think we've ever had a card name with parentheses in it, but
or AKA.
Yeah.
Or just like,
or yeah, a sub, way, like a subline.
The name, just quotation mark, Feather, end quote, and then finish the name.
Or just like a subline with like known aliases and just put
so
on the Azorius rap sheet or whatever.
Oh my gosh. That would be hilarious.
The last thing I got from Commander, real quick, is the single inclusion of an S in. Types of cards. So, Bastion Protector, our boy Victor, amazing art. I think it looks like Arya Stark. That's fine. Cool. But it says, Commander creatures you control get +2/+2 and have indestructible. It's a 3-drop, 3/3.
Right.
That says Commander Creatures, plural. Yes.
So we have this thing. It was in Alpha called Control Magic. You can take control of someone's creature. Yep. So if you have your opponent's commander and your own commander, they would each get +2/+2 and have indestructible.
Does that also open the design? Like
Mike, sorry, I need to interrupt you because you just lobbed it up and Ethan just spiked it right into your face.
Well, it's the easiest way.
Right into your
mind
face.
Mind you, I started in Legends. And my boy Stang makes a 3/4 Stang token.
That's true. That's true.
The
Stang token is
not...
Does
that count as a commander?
If Stang
creature?
Is your commander, I don't believe that the Stang token counts as your commander.
It doesn't. Mm. But that...
Like, I'm positive it does not.
Like
That sounds like a kitchen table rule.
It could be a kitchen table rule.
Brothers like, Yamazaki commander?
Oh, yeah.
It's...
I forgot about those two.
Yeah. Anyway.
Two 50 card decks.
So you're I mean, yeah, Stang versus Brothers Yamazaki. Is there anyone else? Oh, you
that's
could
like
do
a dual,
like,
that's a dual deck in the works.
There's tons of duels.
Like, the two different versions
Tibor
of
and Lemia?
Oh, well. That's all in one card.
That's all in one card though.
But what about Balthor the Stout and Balthor the Defiled?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you could do that.
Having them both on the battlefield is definitely a flavor fail, though.
Oh, yeah. That'd be bad.
Or like any of the two mirrored legends from Lorwyn and Shadowmoor.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Again, that's a flavor fail. You don't you don't want them on the battlefield at once.
Right.
Unless one becomes the other, and then you sack the old one. But yeah, I get you.
Oh, but what about Jisa and Giralf? I guess they were fighting each other all the time. They were never. I guess they teamed up to make Grimgrin, though, didn't they?
They did. They did.
So there's that.
I'm sure A.E. Marlin is just freaking out that you mentioned his boy.
A.E. Marlin is cosplays as Stitcher Giralf quite frequently. And very effectively, I might add.
Yeah. He does not break character.
Ever.
No.
I was really. First, I was just surprised, and then. Really impressed that the entirety of PAX he was in character. I was like, it was not like I just had a conversation with him about writing for Gathering Magic, and he was still in character. I'm like, dude, this is crazy and awesome, and I don't even know.
We invited him to lunch, at GPC Tech, and he had this entire Jace explanation and how he has this other thing going on. Wasn't actually a tournament match that he was playing, but he had to say it as if Jace was saying it. And I'm like, okay, well, then no, we won't go to lunch. Okay, all right, later.
It's awesome.
I'm like, all right.
It's like he's dedicated, man. I love it. It's
In it for days. All right, we it's one other thing I have. There are three Eldrazi, technically. Three types.
This is driving Mike nuts.
Driving me nuts. Driving me nuts. Because I'm an art guy and I see references. And when references don't shoot the gun that's on the wall, why is the gun on the wall?
Wait, what is Chekhov's gun doing there?
Why is the gun there? Don't tell me that you guys don't know. The gun's on the wall. No one's shooting the gun.
This is a writing metaphor, Mike. This is not an art metaphor.
No, it's totally an art metaphor.
I have said that so many times already. It's not getting into his brain. He keeps using it. He's like, the gun is painted on the wall. And I'm like, Mike, that's not how Chekhov's gun works.
It's a still life in the tropics, and there's no pineapple. Or it's in the Arctic area, and they're like, why is there a pineapple on the table? There's got to be a reason that pineapple's there. And, okay, so for people that don't know this, is that in writing or in musicals or plays, if you put, a gun on the wall or they have it, it has to go off or it shouldn't be there. And we're relating this to the Eldrazi because we saw one of Emrakul's little underlings, if you will, kicking it as a 3/4, and we've seen nothing since. So she's off playing somewhere, and we're like, all right, Ulamog's here, Kozilek's here. Is she coming? Is she off? Is she in Shadows Over Innistrad? This is the question that should be yelled every 37 seconds on Twitter.
I agree. We should definitely ask this question a lot.
Oh, it hurts me 1,000 deaths. And it's, I think that a lot of the storyline Vorthos people are very, very curious about this because it's shorter timeline, two sets. Could we have a continuous narrative easier because of this? You have, you know, gothic horror, or is that just a red herring to say, oh, yeah, she's on Innistrad, just hanging out. And you're like, no, gun on the wall. I see the gun on the wall. Is it going off or not? And
you're asking, you know, how many chapters this story has. Is that what you're asking?
It's exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah.
And
more than two.
Oh my God. But that is, I don't know if that was a design decision, because it doesn't really seem to be a development one, because I don't think they would care.
I'm fairly confident that from a developmental standpoint, it doesn't matter where Emrakul is.
Oh my God. But seriously, every day, I want to know
how big she is, wherever she is.
But every day, it's like the same thing. I wake up, you know, it's like 5:30 in the morning. I get my coffee. I sit down and try to knock out some flavor text writing before I go to work. And without fail, at some point during that two-hour span, Mike will blast me with messages on Twitter like, where's Emrakul, Ant? I don't understand. Where's Emrakul? Where's Emrakul? It doesn't make sense. Emrakul's on the wall, Ant, and she's not here. I'm just like, what are you talking about?
No, but I understand that this is totally planned in that sense. And despite some, you know, negative things happening about things getting released early, that this is the most closely guarded secret on will Emrakul be there or not, or be in the next set. And I realize that this isn't a random occurrence. This isn't something that, oh, it just kind of happened and she'll be revealed eventually. This is very thought out, methodical. And I mean, from a design sense, I'm very, very happy you guys made that decision. And because people like me are freaking the hell out. And I am not the only one. I'm not even that much of a storyline person. I'm an art guy, and I'm losing my shit right now. Keep that up. If you guys keep doing that with as things go quicker, and there's a trailer, a caboose that comes late, and it's like, oh, is it going to be in this, or is it going to be in the next set? That's a cool thing. And we Vorthoses love the crap out of that. So kudos to you for working on that or having an influence in that, because God knows you can't freaking tell me.
I will say that our design teams and our writing teams are planning way farther ahead than we ever have before, especially with regard to what the storyline is. So we're not making it up as we go along. We do have a plan, and we're thinking about what's going to be coming down the line. So
is it farther ahead than past sets or past blocks?
Yes, the storyline especially is plotted out much farther ahead than it has been during the Brady Dahmermuth regime.
Interesting.
If I may say the word regime, that's kind of an alarming word, actually.
Yeah, it's like not even going to comment on that, like of his reign, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
His time there. Well, that's fun.
Yeah, he had his own priorities, and the current folks that are in charge now have slightly different priorities, and one of those is planning out bigger story arcs, and so we're trying that out for a while.
That sounds fun.
So far, I like it.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay.
But deep down, you really love being on Commander because you get to do whatever you want.
I love leading any Magic set. I find that Commander sets are easy, and there's a lot of freedom there, whereas designing a booster release is like solving so many problems. It's just like problem solving part of my brain is engaged 100% and is over capacity all the time. I'm never going to solve all these problems. That's why we have a development team. But Commander set is kind of like it's like dessert, right? You can just like eat whatever you want. It's delicious, and you don't have to think about it too much. Obviously, you have to think about it, but it's a lot more about just having fun than it is about solving the hard problems and making everything work.
Right, I hear you. So, you really, the problem to solve is how do you best capture the spirit of Commander?
Yeah, and I feel like I have a clear vision for what I think Commander is at its best, and I try to make these. I try to design these pre-constructed decks so that they'll play in the way that I think is the most fun in Commander.
Okay, you're working on a Bear Legend. Everyone knows this. It's established.
I do. Bear? I mean, I do have a Bear Commander deck with every single bear ever printed and every card with bears in the art ever printed that are in the Commander colors.
Confirm
Ethan. We were playing a game and Ethan used that deck, and he put out what's the unglued card that makes a pink bear token?
Right, what is it?
It's like water gun game, I think.
Water balloon gun game or something.
So he puts it out, and everyone's racking up counters. We're getting closer, and I forget who we were playing with, but they at the last minute they naturalized his water balloon game. And I have never seen someone just with a vengeance want to take someone down out of a Commander game so badly for just destroying his Carnival game.
We were all having fun there. We were all playing games. And whoever it was decided that these games needed to stop before anyone won a prize. And that's not very nice.
No, so I have one final question for you. This is something that I asked Sean Main when we had him on. This was back, oh my gosh, it was Magic Origins, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We had him come on. But I asked him to describe his design. I don't know if it's like a design aesthetic or just a way that if I looked at a card, I could tell that it was a Sean Main card. And what he told us was that he likes to take cards that maybe would be too time-consuming to use or not as much fun to use, for example, Survival of the Fittest, where you're constantly shuffling your deck, and turning it into a more random but also more user-friendly version. So there's an evolution card in Origins where it's basically Survival of the Fittest, but instead of searching your entire deck, you just flip the top five cards of your library, find a creature, put the rest onto the bottom. So it's a lot smoother gameplay. And so I'm wondering if you also have a tell, I guess, to where if I was looking at a card, I could say that's an Ethan Fleischer design.
Wow. I think one of the most Ethan Fleischer cards would probably be Hundred-Handed One. This is a top-down design, but it's a card that makes you laugh. So I try to make people laugh sometimes with numbers and things. So, yeah.
Okay.
It can block up to 99 creatures. Just no big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there an example of that maybe in Battle for Zendikar that you can think of?
Oh, Battle for Zendikar. I certainly had a lot to do with Void Winnower, which is a card that cares about whether numbers are odd or even.
Which is not that's exactly what I was thinking of. Okay.
But that one shook out of a conversation that I had with Tom LaPilli. We were talking about ways to make the Eldrazi feel like they were caring about something that humans wouldn't care about. And we were talking about the way that people generate random numbers. One of the ways they do that is take like wind speed numbers and take the last digit after the decimal point, and that's the random number. It's just like it's a totally random number that can't, you know, it's not generated by a computer. It's generated by nature, and but it doesn't actually mean anything really, right? So we're trying to think about what's the magic equivalent of that concept? We're like, oh, what about parity? What about whether a number is odd or even? That's not something that actually means anything in magic, but it's a thing that a card could care about. Well, we were thinking maybe a whole mechanic. It wasn't the mechanic we ended up using for the Eldrazi for Ulamog's lineage, but it was an intriguing enough concept that it made it onto a card.
You literally can't even, which obviously Reddit loves, but that's fantastic learning. Cool, very cool. All right, Ant, What's up? Is Emrakul in the frickin' set? Ian not gonna shoot.
All right, I think we should wrap before Mike loses it.
Yep, sounds good. We're getting into dangerous territory here. I might accidentally say whether Emrakul is in the set or not, and then I get fired. Oh my gosh. So. God,
dying a thousand. Well, Ethan, thank you so much for hanging out with us tonight, giving us an insight. Always very appreciated. Per always, if there's other cats that, you know, have something interesting, shoot them over. We like to learn about that flavor.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be to chat with you guys.
Well, I mean, otherwise, for anyone else listening, I mean, you could find us at Gathering Magic. We'll post there. We have at SnackTimeCast, the Twitter feed where we post things in there. We are findable on iTunes if you look up SnackTimeCast or Vorthos, oddly enough. You can leave a review there. Let us know about any sort of interesting content. And thanks for watching.